From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For decades, the Irish Republican Army was Catholic Northern Ireland's sword and symbol of armed resistance to British rule. But somewhere along the way, the IRA lost its heroic luster. Now, one-time supporters say it's more like a gang than a liberation front. On January 30th, at a crowded Belfast bar, a brutal murder that had nothing to do with liberation ignited a call for justice by the victim's sisters. Now, their outrage has turned into a political firestorm for the provisional IRA. There is a growing clamor for the IRA to disband. From the White House, where the Mourning Sisters have been invited to spend St. Patrick's Day, to Downing Street, to, most significantly, the IRA's home turf in Belfast. Tonight on Point, fury in Northern Ireland and fresh calls for the Irish Republican Army to stand down, to disband. We begin tonight in Belfast. Dan Keenan is Northern News editor for the Irish Times in Belfast. I asked him what happened to Robert McCartney in that pub on January 30th.
Well, Robert McCartney was a 33-year-old father of two. He drove a forklift truck for a living, and he was out for a drink with some friends in a bar in the city centre in Belfast on the evening of January the 30th. What happened after that is a matter of some dispute, but this much we generally know. He and his friends got into a row with some others in the bar. Others in the bar are believed to have been members of the Provisional Irish Republican Army, the IRA, which has been on ceasefire here since 1997. What happened then was a pub brawl broke out, a very violent one, and it spilled out onto the street outside. Robert and one of his friends was attacked, they were stabbed, they were kicked and beaten. And the following day, Robert McCartney subsequently died in hospital from his injuries, and the police mounted a murder inquiry.
We read that he was beaten with iron pipes, his throat was slit, his torso was slashed open with a knife.
He suffered a very horrible death, there's no two ways about that. And his friend also suffered very grievous injuries, but he survived. And we've seen pictures published in my own newspaper and in others of him stitched from his navel to his throat. And he's also had his throat slashed. And he's had a very, very hard time at the hands of these people that he fell out with in the pub.
Now, the story, as we understand it, is that then the crew went back into the pub, locked the door, swabbed the place down, cleaned off fingerprints and blood, and warned everyone there that this was IRA business and to shut up about it.
Is that? And that's precisely what has happened since. Yes, the place has been forensically cleaned. Yes, the tape from the closed-circuit television camera at the front door has been removed. Yes, the murder weapon that was taken from the kitchen of the pub and used to murder Robert McCartney and injure his friend has been taken and has been allegedly destroyed. And yes, of the 70 or so people who were in the bar at the time, some people have come forward, but they have said they saw nothing. They were in the toilet at the time or they weren't looking. But nobody has come forward and provided any useful witness evidence so far from the bar to the police.
Now, put that in historical context for us. There's a long history of that kind of silence around IRA activity. What's the origin of that and how strong is that tradition?
It's a very strong tradition, especially amongst the community from which Robert McCartney came. He is from an area called Short Strand. It's a little Catholic nationalist enclave in East Belfast, about 10 minutes' walk from the pub from where he died. And it has had a certain sympathy with the political cause which the IRA has followed over the last 30 to 35 years.
A certain sympathy, to put it mildly.
Absolutely. And the IRA, because it sees itself as being at war with the British presence in Northern Ireland, has always come down very heavily against members of its local community from having anything to do with the police, anything to do with the courts, anything to do with British institutions in general. And if they say nobody saw anything in this pub, well, then that's what happens, and that's what happened in this case.
But in this case, what they didn't reckon on was Robert McCartney's sisters. What happened there?
Well, what has happened since then is that Mr. McCartney's five sisters and also his partner, a woman called Bridgine Higgins, the mother of his two children, have basically taken a very public and a very political stance to say, no, we're not going to keep quiet. No, we are going to insist on justice in this case. We have our own ideas as to who was responsible for Robert's murder, and they're going to insist that the people who did this to him account for themselves publicly in a court of law. They say they don't want any IRA justice. They want the justice that they believe can only come through a court of law, and they want to see the people guilty of his murder convicted and jailed.
And then this week, the whole story ratcheting up again when the IRA offers publicly, formally, to, if I've got this right, shoot four men they say they believe were responsible for the killing.
That's exactly right. This statement was released earlier this week and has taken a great deal of people by surprise. Certainly the people in Northern Ireland who thought that they couldn't be shocked by anything the IRA did anymore, and also the British and the Irish governments, as well as all the political parties here. The IRA released a statement, as I say, earlier this week in which they restated their account of the events in the pub that night. Mm. They've said that they've carried out an extensive inquiry into what happened because they have accepted now that some of its members were involved in the incident, although they say that the murder was not sanctioned by the IRA at its highest level. And in terms of getting justice in the case, which the sisters have demanded, they have said that they were prepared to shoot the people who were involved in the murder of Robert McCartney. That offer, needless to say, has been rejected by the McCartney sisters and by his common-law wife, Ms. Higgins, and they continue to insist that the justice they want to see is not IRA justice, but the justice that pertains in a court of law.
Now, from that point, the whole thing spirals up to a much higher level. We've had condemnation of this offer of execution right across the board in Ireland and the UK. Give us a taste of that.
Well, it has been mentioned by both the Prime Ministers of Britain and the Irish Republic. Tony Blair has condemned it in the House of Commons. The Prime Minister of the Irish Republic, Bertie Ahern, has done the same. And because both governments have been working very closely in trying to secure a political settlement here in Northern Ireland, both have insisted that there cannot be any political settlement here in Northern Ireland, including Sinn Féin, which is the political party associated most with the IRA, mm-hmm. until all paramilitary and criminal activity has verifiably come to a halt.
And now we see President Bush's special envoy to Northern Ireland, Michael Rees, calling for the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, to disband. Is there any precedent for this from Washington, from essentially the White House?
Well, there have been calls for the IRA to disband for quite some time now, mostly because, as I said to you earlier, they called a ceasefire in 1997. There was an historic peace accord signed here in Belfast in 1998.
So what's the point of having an armed wing in that
case?
Well,
exactly. This is the whole thing, and this is the political point that has constantly been put to the Republican movement, the Irish Republican movement in general. Yes, Sinn Féin is doing well at the polls. Yes, they have had members in a short-lived cross-party, cross-community government here in Northern Ireland, which is now in suspension. But what is the point of having a private army whenever you've gone down the constitutional path? I think at one stage both governments and indeed the electorate here were quite prepared to put up with a little bit of ambiguity in the short term while the transition was made from an armed conflict to an entirely peaceful and constitutional path. But that was 1998 and this is 2005, and people like Robert McCartney are still being killed. So, as you rightly say, the calls for the IRA to disband have been ratcheted up, not just by the McCartney sisters, not just by the electorate as a whole, not just by the two governments, but also by the governments on both sides of the Atlantic as well.
What about Irish Catholics in Northern Ireland? Are there opinion polls? Can you tell how the IRA's standing goes now?
An opinion poll was published today. Unfortunately, the research was carried out before the IRA made its statement in which it offered to the McCartney family to have Robert's killer shot. But it contains quite some startling findings. First among those is the opinion of 60% of Catholics generally who say that they want the provost to go. That's the provisional IRA. They want him to disband. They want him to stand down. They don't want to hear any more about them ever again. The figure rises to 70% for those in the Catholic community who want all of the IRA's illegal weapons and explosives to be verifiably decommissioned and put beyond use. So it seems as if the push for the IRA to step down and to go out of business is rising steadily amongst the Catholics in Northern Ireland.
And what about Gerry Adams, head of Sinn Féin, of course, the political wing here? What is he saying?
Gerry Adams is doing his level best to align himself as closely as possible with the McCartney family and also with wider opinion throughout society here.
Is it working?
Up to a point. He still retains good contact with the family. In fact, he visited them privately in their home in Belfast this afternoon. This is in advance of the McCartney sisters making a visit to Washington next week when I believe they're going to be hosted by President Bush at the White House on St. Patrick's Day.
Yes.
It's a difficult one for Sinn Féin because they are aligned with the IRA. IRA members were involved in Robert McCartney's murder. And so far, nobody has turned up and said, yes, I was in the pub at the time. I will give you valuable witness evidence. That just hasn't happened yet. And therefore, it's a difficult one because the sisters continue to insist that IRA members are holding back on this. And yet, on the other hand, we have Gerry Adams calling on everyone to come forward and endorsing the sisters' wish for people to be made accountable in court. It's a difficult one for him.
Now I'm reading Anthony McIntyre, former IRA member himself, saying it's devolved into an organization just doing extortion, robberies, mutilations, intimidation, the occasional murder. He writes the IRA started out as a guerrilla army. It has since changed into an armed party militia. Dan Keenan, do you see the IRA going away, or does it still have staying power? Will we be talking about it years down the road?
The IRA has been around for a very long time. It wasn't invented in the late 1960s when the latest outburst of troubles erupted onto the streets of Northern Ireland. It's been in existence for many, many more decades than that. I think it could well be, we could well push for a situation whereby the IRA may stand down or may get rid of its weapons. It's already decommissioned three various tranches of some of its weapons, but it's still in existence. The difficulty is it's the idea that keeps the IRA going, and you can't abolish the IRA. You may disband it at some stage. You may push it to get rid of its weapons. But as has happened in the past, if it disappears for a while, it has a tendency to come back. I would be very loath to write off the IRA at this stage, even though I wouldn't rule out in the short term some dramatic initiative from the IRA to try and meet the demands of public opinion here.
But the heat is on, perhaps like never before. Dan Keenan with the Irish Times, joining us from Belfast. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
Dan Keenan is the Northern News Editor for the Irish Times. Speaking with us there from Belfast, we are talking tonight about the uproar in Northern Ireland and fresh calls for the disbanding of the Irish Republican Army. You can join the conversation tonight. Is it time for the IRA to stand down, to disband? Can it be done? How? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Much more to come. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about an uproar in Northern Ireland and fresh calls for the disbanding of the Irish Republican Army, the IRA. You can join the conversation tonight. Is it time to disband the IRA? Can it be done? How? Were IRA members once heroes to you? Are they still? Should the men who slit Robert McCartney's throat in Belfast get IRA justice or formal justice in the courts? We're at 1-800-423-8255 tonight. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Bethesda, Maryland, is Bruce Morrison, former Democratic congressman from Connecticut. He was a primary advisor to Bill Clinton on Ireland's troubles and helped broker ceasefires in 1997 and 98. Bruce Morrison, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome.
And with me in the studio in Boston tonight is Kevin Cullen, reporter for the Boston Globe. He's former Dublin bureau chief for the Globe and has covered Northern Ireland for nearly 20 years. Kevin Cullen, great to have you here.
Same here, Tom.
Bruce Morrison, what do you see going on here? These sisters have made a big noise. The White House has turned away Gerry Adams and others from the St. Patrick's observation. Do we have a tipping point here for the IRA?
Well, we have a very sad day, things having gone downhill, I think, in very dramatic ways, perhaps inevitably so, perhaps not. I think it's something that's been coming to a head for a long time. It's really not new news calling for the stand down of the IRA. It's always been a question of when and how, not if, that was a necessary condition to the peace process really being concluded.
Remind us, Bruce Morrison, where things do stand today compared to the high point of peace talks and cooperation.
Well, high points are sometimes measured in words and low points in deeds. So one has to be careful not to be deluded.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It was certainly a very high point when the IRA decided in 1994 to have a ceasefire. And that was a real thing, and real things did change as a result of that decision. It was nothing like perfection. There were still punishment beatings and other such things, but the bombing campaign and the like, shootings regularly occurring, that was a real thing, and that occurred in 1994. It broke down in 1996 and was restored in 1997. Those things were real progress. Real progress was also the Good Friday Agreement, which created a political framework, which is still being pursued, but certainly on paper suggested a way forward in which discrimination against Catholics in the North could be brought to an end. Political representation could be achieved on an equal province-wide basis. That there could be a legislature for Northern Ireland. That the future of Northern Ireland would be decided by the consent of the people of Northern Ireland, and that there would be North-South institutions between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland that would allow evolution of island-wide institutions. A lot of good things in there. Also, human rights protections and development of a new police force, not tied to the Protestant or Unionist community the way it historically had been. Some progress on implementing all of that, much slower than people would have hoped, and not just on the side of the disarmament or standing down of the IRA, certainly on the side of the disarmament or standing down of loyalist paramilitaries, of really getting the police force changed as much as possible. Everything in the agreement has gone slower than one would hope, perhaps predictably so. That may be used as an excuse by some for the problems that we're having with respect to the IRA. I don't think those are excuses for the kind of violence that we're talking about right now.
And Kevin Cullen, for all that, the stand that these sisters, the McCartney sisters, have taken has really got people's attention. Everyone's saying there's something new here. There's a kind of hell no, we won't take this kind of behavior in any case going on that people just haven't seen before.
Yeah, I think the McCartney sisters isn't really what's new. Over the years, when the IRA have meted out summary justice, people have stood up and said, this is wrong. I think what's really different here is the reaction of their neighbors and their friends. People used to be afraid to stand in solidarity and say, I agree with them, the provos were wrong. The difference is the 1,000, the 1,500 people that turned out for Robert McCartney's funeral, the more than 1,000 people that turned out for a rally, that is open defiance of the Provisional IRA, and it has never happened before in the heartland, in the areas like Short Strand, that they control. And that's what's remarkable. And I think that's why you've seen such extraordinary measures, the fact that the IRA acknowledged expelling three of its members, the fact that they the funny thing about this, showing how different the different world they are in compared to everybody else, is they actually thought by acknowledging publicly that they offered to shoot these fellows, and then turning it down, that people would somehow say, well, wasn't that a gesture of restraint?
They'd get credit for
that.
They'd
get credit for it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the other thing, I know everybody was shocked and appalled at what I took from it, from having covered these guys for 20 years now, is this is the first time I could ever recall that they gave anybody the say who gets shot and who doesn't. That isn't the way they operate. It's never been a way. And it, to me, indicates how serious this is in their own constituency, in their own backyard.
Now, we should say in the IRA's formal statement that they also said that the people should feel free to go ahead through the courts as well. It wasn't only that we'll execute these guys. That was an option. They said we can execute them or we give our sanction to this going through the courts. Kevin, how do you interpret... if it's new, this rallying around the aggrieved party, in this case the McCartney sisters, how do you interpret why that happened this time? Are these charismatic sisters, the kind of lineup of all of them protesting, or is it the moment at which things stand in Ireland?
There's a confluence of political events here. The bottom line is, even in places like the Short Strand, life on the ground is better than it was 10 years ago. And, you know, for that, the IRA should be given credit for that. In 1994, it was historic. It's the word that's overused in the peace process, but it was historic. They stopped shooting soldiers. They stopped shooting cops. They continued on as a paramilitary operation, but for all intents and purposes, the war was over. Now, it took years. Now we're into 10, 11 years since that ceasefire, and that people on the ground, they are saying the war's over. I mean, the peace process is stalled, really, repeatedly at the end of the day. Now, as Bruce mentioned, there's movement on the other side that needs to come from unionists and from loyalists. But really, what we're really talking about, the stops and starts, comes down to the fact that the IRA has not explicitly said their war is over. What we are seeing now is that people that have always supported the IRA are saying it for them. They are saying the war is over. You have no right to do this kind of stuff anymore.
Listen to us. If you're fighting in our name, then hear this message. Bruce Morrison, how has the Bush administration interacted with this issue? You were very involved in the Clinton administration's approach. What's happened in this the follow-on administration?
Various things, and the times are very different, and the opportunities to influence the process are different from what they were when the Clinton administration really changed the terms of engagement for the United States in 1993 and 1994, and I think had a very dramatic positive effect. I have no quarrel with what the Bush administration has decided most recently. I would say that they downgraded the level of attention to this situation from day one when they came in, and like other peace processes where they downgraded the level of attention, things certainly didn't get better, and in many cases they got worse. Sometimes it's better to leave a peace process alone for a while. Oftentimes, though, lack of attention, lack of pressure allows people to go on with their usual way of doing business rather than face up to changes that need to be made. So I would say Bush administration certainly done nothing wrong in what they're doing now, done nothing wrong over their 4.5 years, but could have had a higher level of engagement all through the process, with some perhaps having moved the process beyond this point and maybe prevented coming to this point.
I want to turn to our callers. We're talking tonight about the furor in Northern Ireland over the death of Robert McCartney. His sisters have stood up and said very loudly, "We're fed up with this." And as our guest Kevin Cullen points out, a lot of Irish Catholics have rallied around them. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. How do you read what's going on in Northern Ireland? What's going on with the IRA? 1-800-423-TALK. John is calling from Boston. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yes. My point is, nobody was asking the British Army to decommission their weapons when Patrick Finucane was shot dead, or Catholic people who would shoot to kill policies. In fact, I hear there's been no prosecution of British soldiers. And I think what's going on is just like in Lebanon, you know, they can construct the media to make a point of view that this is the way it is.
John, let me ask you, are you not sympathetic to the McCartney sisters whose brother died, throat slit, beat to death with lead pipes, torso cut open?
Oh, yes, I am. But Sinn Féin is gaining power, and Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have as little time for Sinn Féin as the Unionist or Tony Blair. That's really what's at issue here. And they can put the McCartney family under the microscope, but I believe that, you know, they're making no move to have a power-sharing agreement, and they're putting all the onus on Sinn Féin, which has an electoral mandate that got votes within their community, and they keep referring to the fact that, look, if the IRA went away tomorrow, they'd find another reason.
John, we've got it, and thanks for your call. Kevin Cullen, how about it? Here's the cry. Look, don't ask them to put down their arms until everybody does, and there's still the British Army, and forget about it.
Well, I mean, I think the caller raises a reasonable point in the sense that there are a lot of injustices in the past, but I don't think that's what's at it. And it might also raise the point that you need a truth and reconciliation process similar to the situation in South Africa so that people can address those past grievances. But I think, you know, that argument kind of ignores the realities that we're trying to get a political deal done here. And when people suggest, when people in Sinn Féin or supporters of Sinn Féin say that the southern government is afraid or southern parties are afraid of their rise, there's an element of truth to that. But I think the other reality is that Sinn Féin will never realize its electoral potential, particularly in the south of Ireland, until the IRA no longer exists.
I would say that, you know, it's possible for almost everything that caller just said to be true and not thereby say that what's gone on, you know, the direction that's gone on with the IRA most recently makes any sense. In other words, yeah, there are a lot of other bad things that have been done in the past and that may still be being done. The Finucane case clearly is not being investigated as it should be and hasn't been for over 15 years. That's a fair point. But the question of whether that justifies, this vigilante justice that's been offered up, or whether it justifies what was initially done when the brawl happened in the bar and the cleaning of the bar and the whole
all
ocean.
The rest.
Those are things that nobody should be justifying on the basis two wrongs don't make a right,
yep.
And we're trying to make some rights to replace some wrongs, and everybody has to face up to their responsibilities.
Running on two tracks here, Roz is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Roz, you're on the air. Hello, Roz, are you?
I wanted to say that, in post 9/11 days, I feel that people on both sides of the Atlantic have woken up to the reality that the IRA is a Neanderthal organization that has to go away, that we really don't have time in our lives for the kind of violence and sectarian beliefs that they represent, and that it's probably time, too, for people like Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness to step down from Sinn Féin because they're too closely identified with the violent history of the IRA.
But what about their electoral victories? Doesn't that buy them credibility, Roz, if nothing else?
I think that that's history. And I think that if there were other candidates who represented a new generation and who represented Roman Catholic interests, that they would be voted for now. I think that People, what's just happened recently is so grotesque. The idea that the IRA would suggest shooting these men suddenly puts in boldface who they really are and what they represent, which is just thuggish violence.
It's pretty rough justice. Then there has been a lot of rough stuff over the years. Roz, thanks very much for your call. I want to turn right now to Evanston, Illinois. We're joined from there by Lawrence McCaffrey. He's professor emeritus of Irish and Irish-American history at Loyola University, Chicago, author of The Irish Question, Two Centuries of Conflict, and The Irish Catholic Diaspora in America. Lawrence McCaffrey, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I wonder if you'd look at the point the IRA is at right now in the context of everything going on in Northern Ireland, and put the same question to you I put to Bruce Morrison. Is it at some kind of tipping point? Is it being rejected, as Kevin Cullen's suggesting here, by its own base?
It's also being rejected by its American base, too. I know that Gerry Adams has not only been shunned by the White House, but two occasions where he was supposed to try to get some money have been canceled, too. The fact is that in Bush's attitude towards what is going on pretty much represents American, and I'm a Democrat who didn't vote for Bush and never would, but the fact is that he sort of represents the fact is that Irish America itself is getting tired of Northern Ireland. It's been 7 years since the 1998 peace agreement, and the fact is that we don't have any confidence that anything is really going to happen, and we don't believe, I don't believe anyway, a lot of my friends don't believe, that the IRA is really going away for a number of reasons. Not only is it the cause, it's also who they are. In essence, they're a bunch of thugs who were only significant in the liberation movement, but now that it's over, they would be ordinary people and lose their status and lose their respect, and they've had power, and they want to keep power.
But isn't, you mentioned the Bush administration's attitude, isn't it sending some kind of signal by asking Gerry Adams to stay home next week on St. Patrick's Day and instead inviting the aggrieved McCartney sisters?
Yeah, it also fits in with his, make-believe war on terror, you can't support the IRA if you're fighting, as I say, this make-believe war on terror.
You can't support the, because you see them as part of a terror universe.
Well, they are a terrorist organization. Obviously, they're a terrorist organization.
And so you would expect Bush to roll them right in with the rest of that campaign?
Well, yeah, I think he would. I think he would. I think, a lot of the Irish Americans have defected from the Democratic to the Republican Party, so he's not going to offend them by putting a shun on Gerry Adams.
Kevin Cullen, that we haven't heard from Washington. That would be a whole new perspective on the IRA. They've never had the terrorist tag put on.
Yeah, one thing I thought was interesting is the way the Bush administration, they could very easily pandered to the right wing in Britain and to a lesser extent in Ireland and excluded simply Sinn Féin from the St. Patrick's festivities at the White House on Thursday.
But they didn't.
They chose not to do that, and that is probably a credit to the diplomacy of the Irish government, certainly, and I wouldn't be surprised also the British government Tony Blair and Bertie Ahern both are saying that they do not want to. They know they need Sinn Féin to really cement this deal. So to see that the Bush people did not exclude only Sinn Féin suggests a little more sophistication on the part of the White House than I think many people would give them credit for.
Drawing a line, slicing it a little finer there than just saying no to Gerry Adams, even at a time when there's a lot of furor in Northern Ireland itself. Kevin Cullen here in Boston, Bruce Morrison in Bethesda, Maryland, and Lawrence McCaffrey in Evanston, Illinois. Please stand by. We're talking tonight about an uproar in Northern Ireland and fresh calls for the disbanding of the IRA. You can join us. Why can't Northern Ireland make it the last few yards to real peace? Is the IRA to blame? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the uproar in Northern Ireland and fresh calls for the disbanding of the Irish Republican Army, the IRA. I'm joined tonight by Kevin Cullen, reporter for the Boston Globe, spent many years covering Northern Ireland, by Bruce Morrison, U.S. Congressman from Connecticut from 83 to 91. He was a principal advisor to President Clinton on Irish affairs, led a delegation to Ireland which was instrumental in negotiating a ceasefire with the IRA. He's currently chairman of the Morrison Public Affairs Group. And from Evanston, Illinois, by Lawrence McCaffrey, professor emeritus at Loyola University Chicago, author of The Irish Question. You can join the conversation as well. Is it time to disband the IRA? Were IRA members once heroes to you? Are they still? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Good evening, John.
Good evening.
I don't think you're going to get the IRA to disband. Well, first of all, the provisional IRA has certainly become something of a mafia. And I'm wondering, you know, they beat a poor guy in a pub called Kelly's Cellars a few years ago, beat him with iron bars, and, you know, they've gotten into all kinds of riffraff. But for the Catholic population at large, this is a population that knows that British justice for so long colluded in you know, basically supporting loyalist death squad who killed random Catholics. And it would be ironic at this point if this poor community had to look to these same institutions for justice. And, you know, I think one of the reasons why, you know, whether the IRA disbands or quiets down and then comes back again, but I think you're not going to get rid of people like Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness. And by the way, I'm no Provo supporter. You're not going to get rid of these guys till British military intelligence quits running the police force up there. I think this is underreported by Mr. Cullen's publication, but, you know, that's not a municipal police force running up there. That's run by British military intelligence. And it's, you know, their goal is to project British power.
So John, we've got it. Let me put it to Kevin Cullen. He's right here. Kevin, John says, hey, let's look at how things still really run up there. And the suggestion is there's still a reason for the IRA.
No, I think there is, and that's why the IRA hasn't gone away. I don't think it's quite as stark as the caller suggests today. But there are long memories and people. But like I said, we can sit here and talk about all day that the White House wants them to go away, that the Irish government wants them to go, that the vast majority of Irish people want them to go away. The Irish Republican Army is a vanguard movement. It does not respond to democratic principles or demands. It responds and only exists because the community that spawns it and supports it agrees. That is what's at play here. That the IRA could not exist today if people did not allow them to dump weapons some places, if they did not inform on volunteers who are on missions, whether it's just surveillance missions or walking around or kneecapping the kid down at the corner that peed on Mrs. Murphy's door. Mm-hmm. That stuff can only exist with community support.
And so when the poll says 60% want the provost to go, you're saying that still leaves 40%.
It's like everything. It's just like saying Irish America is a monolith. It isn't. And that's the same with Irish Catholics. If you're a comfortable Catholic sitting in a middle-class suburb somewhere in Northern Ireland, you don't need the IRA or care about them or ever appreciated them. You saw them as thugs and terrorists.
But the McCartney sisters were not from that comfortable suburb.
They're not. The people in the Short Strand were from a classically vulnerable place on the peace line that they would call, in which they were very susceptible to loyalist attack from East Belfast. So this is why this is so significant. These are people who never did consider the IRA criminals.
And Kevin, what about the Irish-American community? It's also been a very substantial source of support for Sinn Féin and the IRA. Lawrence McCaffrey saying Irish-Americans are fed up. Of course, that's a big number of people.
Yeah,
how do you see it?
I mean, like I said, I don't think there is a monolithic Irish-American community. There are 40 million Americans, according to the last census, who say they have of Irish descent. I've always said the vast majority of them think that IRA stands for Individual Retirement Account. They don't even know what the IRA is. Within that subsection, there are people who are very, very involved in this. They play it out as activists, but whether they are a identifiable voting or lobbying bloc, you know, that remains to be seen as we go forward. But clearly, Irish Americans have played a crucial role. Bruce Morris and people like that, who really did, you know, bring American power and influence to the peace process and got us to the point where we had the agreement in 1998. It's been the implementation of the agreement that's been the devil in the detail.
Jim is calling from Ontario, Canada. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
One thing I'm concerned about is whether or not decrediting the provisionals will leave an opening for some of the other groups that have been low profile, the remnants of the continuity IRA, the real IRA, remnants of the old officials that broke up so many times. They're just practically, and moving forward, the provisionals have been sitting on them so that they can't come up, but this might be an advantage, and they don't think the war is over, believe me, and they're still there. And is this...
So even if the IRA went, is there still a kind of other strands that would come into play? Jim, let us pick that up. Bruce Morrison, how about it? Is this just going to be a persistent part of Northern Irish life? I mean, we saw this $50 million bank robbery. That's pretty big time. I don't know if that's a political act in someone's interpretation, but it sure is a big robbery.
Yeah, well, I think the most important thing to say at this point is that the caller makes a very good point. And it really counters what an earlier caller said about Adams and McGuinness should just go away. The process of demilitarizing the IRA, changing it from a military organization to a political support group or a private business, not engaged in illegal conduct, whatever that process is, that's going to take leadership. It's not going to happen. It's not going to be ordered by the British or the Irish or the American governments. It's going to be forced in some sense by people in the Short Strand and other places like that. But it's going to take leadership. That's where Adams and McGuinness play a key role. And if this set of events triggers their having to move in a particular direction in order to maintain political credibility, that could be a very good thing. But a vacuum is not going to make the situation better. As the gentleman suggests, there are other people who are still into mischief in Northern Ireland, and not all of them are Catholics or Republicans either. There are plenty of loyalists who are into serious mischief.
Let's get a call. Elizabeth is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
I am on the air.
Yes,
thank
ma'am.
You. I know a lot about Northern Ireland and the women there. I've written a book about them. I think that what the six women there have done has been enormously courageous. It's never been done before. And I think that they have broken open a gate that can make a change in what is happening there. I want to see them honored for their courage, and I want to see what they're trying to do exposed. And, you know, we don't need these old guys there anymore. We need the new young people who will say, we're going to make a change. And they have tried to make a change, and their courage is fabulous.
Is this Elizabeth Shannon?
Elizabeth Shannon.
Wife of the former U.S. ambassador in Ireland.
Yes, it is.
Ms. Shannon, what do you think is on the other side of that gate that you see the sisters having broken down? What's out there to move toward?
Oh, to move towards the people in all the people of every side in Northern Ireland saying, we're not going to be told by any terrorist organization what to do. We're going to move along in a lawful, courageous way and make a country that is admired by the rest of the world and not held up as, you know, a country that's been in turmoil by and held by terrorists. We're just going to move along and do our thing, and that's what they're trying to do. That's what those women are trying to do. I don't know them. I admire them so much, and they are the first, and I really want to emphasize that, the first who have come out and said that we won't be castigized as informers. We're just women who want to say, come on, let's just do it.
And not just come out, but as Kevin Cullen says, been rallied around to a significant degree. Elizabeth Shannon, thank you so much for calling in tonight.
You're welcome.
Lawrence McCaffrey, what's your thought here? Do you see daylight? Does all this amount to a real change in the chemistry of this situation somehow, or are we still just in train? Mr. McCaffrey, are you there?
Yes. I'm very pessimistic about any real change in Northern Ireland. This has been going on since 1968. I mean, it just keeps going on and on and on. The same characters are there. It really doesn't seem to make much difference what the majority of people want. It's what the thugs want that seems to happen. And in reference to what Kevin Cullen said, Irish-American opinion pretty much goes from east to west, you know, and the more Irish-Americans become settled, quite often Republican, the less interested they are in what goes on in Ireland, particularly Northern Ireland. So I don't think there's going to be very much American input anymore, and I don't think for much there's... I've always admired the courage of the Clinton administration, because it's probably the most courageous thing the Clinton administration ever did, was get involved in Northern Ireland, because I don't think there were really that many votes in it.
Though it still resonates, and with that we're out of time. Lawrence McCaffrey, Professor Emeritus at Loyola University Chicago, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Bruce Morrison, former negotiator advisor to Bill Clinton on Northern Ireland, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And Kevin Cullen with the Boston Globe, always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for being
Thanks,
here, Kevin.
Tom.
In a moment, a citywide strike grinds Paris to a halt. This is On Point. Tens of thousands of striking workers paralyzed Paris today, on a day when the International Olympic Committee was in town evaluating the city's bid to host the 2012 Olympic Games. Paris has been considered the favorite among the cities being considered for 2012. The workers were protesting government moves to lengthen France's beloved 35-hour work week. Subways were snarled, commuter trains were canceled, streets were filled with supporters of the 35-hour week. I spoke earlier with Peter Ford, chief European correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's based in Paris. I asked him to describe the scene in Paris today.
Yes, well, it depended where you were and what you were trying to do. If you were trying to get to work in Paris, you were crammed onto one of the very few metro underground lines that were running, or onto one of the buses that was taking the overflowed. If you were a striking worker, you were on the streets waving banners and demanding that the government stop its attempts to roll back the 35-hour week.
We see reports of tens of thousands of marchers in cities all across the country.
Yes, there were. There are different estimates. The unions say there were up to 1 million people in one city or another. The police say it's more like 500,000. But either way you cut it, there were a lot of people who are not happy with this government.
Peter, take us into this issue of the 35-hour work week. That sounds very unfamiliar to most Americans, of course. And here's France putting the whole country on strike, at least the labor unions, in an attempt to defend it. How long have they had a 35-hour work week, and what's being proposed now that would change it?
The 35-hour work week was introduced by the previous government, the socialist government led by Léonard Jospin, 4 or 5 years ago. And to be perfectly frank, radical though it sounds to American ears, it has very quickly caught on in this country. People are really using their spare time, and they have got used to not working every hour that God sends. The government that is now in charge, the Conservative government led by Jean-Pierre Raffarin, says that this can't go on, that the country cannot afford to pay people effectively the same wages for doing less work, and would like to offer workers the opportunity to work longer and companies the opportunity to make people work longer if they needed or wanted to. Even though that wouldn't be obligatory, the trade unions see this as a breach in the wall, if you like, and suspect that it's just the first step in rolling back the whole idea of a 35-hour week and going back to 40 hours.
What's the government's evidence that it can't go on?
It's a problem of economic malaise, frankly. I mean, this government is trying to do a lot of things to reform the French economy, to make it more dynamic, more competitive, and bring it, as they would say, into the 21st century. Frankly, none of the reforms it has undertaken have seemed very full-throated. They've begun to reform the pension system. They've begun to make people pay a little for their health care. But nobody gets the impression, even those who support the reforms, that they're really making a tremendous difference to French economic performance. And those who don't support the reforms see their benefits being eroded. So one way or another, there just seems to be a general dissatisfaction with the government at the moment. And I think that's what motivated a great deal of the protest today. In fact, surprisingly to many, 65% of French people supported the strikers today, whether or not they were inconvenienced by them.
Peter, you're there in Paris, where, by the current law, people work 35-hour weeks. Can you feel that in the life of the city, in the life around France? Can you feel the difference between a 35-hour week nation and nations where the work week is longer?
You certainly do. The way the 35-hour work week goes is that you may not work 35 hours, or you may work longer than that, but then you will get 1 or 2 days off that you can add to a weekend. If you go out of Paris on a Thursday evening on a train or in the car, you will see the roads and the public transport packed, and they're packed with people who are taking long weekends. There is definitely a sense in the last few years that people are taking more leisure time, using more leisure time, and that, of course, has had economic advantages for some sectors. I mean, the local tourism industry has done very nicely out of it. There's also a more leisurely sense of life, perhaps there always was in France, than there is in Germany or Switzerland or neighboring countries. And I think the French have just learned if they've got it, they're going to flaunt it and enjoy it.
We see a union leader yesterday saying, our watchwords are clear, that is, in this strike. We want jobs, wages, and the 35-hour week. Can the French have it all? What do the economists say there?
Well, the whole idea of the 35-hour week originally was that if those who did have jobs worked less, then there would be more jobs to go around, and it would reduce unemployment. That hasn't worked. I mean, I think the whole idea of the 35-hour work week has proved to have been based on a false economic premise, that there is a fixed chunk of labor that you can split up. I mean, I think what it will take to create more jobs is not fiddling around with the work week. It needs economic growth. It needs a certain dynamism in the French economy and in the European economy, which we haven't seen for some time.
Meanwhile, all this national strike gridlock as the Olympic Committee is in town to look at Paris as the location for the 2012 Games. Has that dented the impression that Paris is making on the Olympic muckety-mucks?
Well, I think it's obviously taken some of the shine off it, but the unions were very careful today to stage their demonstrations well away from the areas where the IOC delegation was inspecting potential Olympic sites, and they were all out there saying that we support the Paris bid. I think that even though it doesn't look good, if you'd like to be able to take your IOC visiting delegation on a tour of your very efficient metro, it's unfortunate if only one train in four is running. But I think they know that what happened today is not really going to have any effect on what will happen 7 years hence, which is when the Olympic Games would be staged.
Peter Ford in Paris, thanks a lot for joining us. Good luck getting around there this week.
Thanks very much.
Peter Ford, Chief European Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amata, Jim Moses, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.